life I live, a figure made of clay, and think about the things I lost, the things I gave away. And when I'm in a certain mood, I search the halls and look. One night I found these magic words in a magic book. Throw it away, give of your love, live your life each and every day, and keep your hand wide open, let sun shine through, 'cause you can never lose a thing if it belongs to you.
A critic wrote recently in a rave review that Abby Lincoln's contralto thrives on notes found in the cracks of the piano keyboard. I don't know whether Miss Lincoln appreciates this assessment, but the listener knows that just what he's trying to say. It's a quality something akin to psychodrama that we remember from treasured performances by Billie Holiday and Edith Piaf. Abby Lincoln's been around a while now, beginning with a performance in The Girl Can't Help It, a 1956 film that also featured Jane Mansfield, Julie London, and Little Richard. But only in the last decade has she received praise of the sort Gary Giddens of the Village Voice gave when he wrote, "She is with little precedent in jazz." Her latest album is A Turtle's Dream on Verve, which brings her here today. And it is my great honor to welcome Abby Lincoln, a.k.a. Anna Maria Woolridge, and Gabby Lee, the New York & Company. Hi, how are you?
Thank you, Leonard. I'm happy to be here, too.
At the beginning, you were a singer-actress or an actress-singer. How did you see yourself when you started?
I didn't know I would have a chance to make films. I didn't study to be an actress. I started as a singer, and I thought I would... I didn't have ambitions for a career until I was about 25, and I met some people who encouraged me to think of myself as a potential star. But at first, I was just singing to make a living. I was so thankful I could make a living singing, and I wanted to get married, and I didn't know all this was before me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, you were more of a cabaret singer in those days. Mm-hmm. The jazz came later.
Well, they didn't call it jazz then. They didn't call it rock. The music wasn't so separated then. I went to Honolulu with a band from New Orleans, the Rampart Streeters. Mm-hmm. And they were excellent, and they'd play the blues and sing the blues sometimes. I remember the saxophone player singing Love for Sale. And I'd come to the stage and sing the songs I heard Billie Holiday and Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald sing. Those were my beginning.
And that you were Gabby Lee at that time?
No, I was Anna Marie. And then I came to Los Angeles in 1955, and I became Gabby Lee. I changed my name so that I could work at this at the Moulin Rouge in a French review.
Mm-hmm. So G-A-B-Y was very French.
Yes, but so was Anna Marie, but none of us knew it.
Well, you speak French, but that's something you picked up
a
later.
A little.
Because you sing a song in French here.
Avec le temps.
Yeah, and your accent is very good, I thought.
Oh, thank you, Leonard. I'm working to perfect it. Mm-hmm.
So suddenly, here you are, somebody who has little dreams of stardom, in this movie, The Girl Can't Help It, wearing a dress that Marilyn Monroe once wore. you sure had the figure for it, but it wasn't... how did that happen?
It was just a quirk of fate. My manager named Bob Russell was a good friend to Lionel Newman, who was the musical director. Mm-hmm. And
the Newman family is just incredible
in
the movie music business.
And because he and Bob were friends, he did Bob a favor and asked him to write a song for the film. And Bob wrote it for me, Bob asked him to have me in the film. That's how I got it. Mm-hmm. And I went to the studio, and I took my dresses, but they weren't what they wanted me to wear, so they found this dress in wardrobe, they said, that Marilyn Monroe had worn. And it caused a lot of excitement in the studio and the photographers. Anyway, I used that for a while. God knows it's true. It almost killed me dead, too, because suddenly I wasn't seen as much of a talent. But the accent was on the way I looked. They said I was very beautiful, whatever that is. Anyway, I got through it. Mm-hmm.
But it didn't get you another movie role for a while. In fact, the next film you were in is one of the great classics, Nothing But a Man by Michael Romer in 1964. You and Ivan Dixon, and both of you went on to odd careers after that. Ivan Dixon, if I remember correctly, wound up directing Hogan's Heroes television shows.
No, well, he was
when he wasn't acting.
He was acting
and he starred in it too.
Yeah. But he also started directing other pieces after he finished with Hogan's Heroes. I think he's in Honolulu now. He has a radio station over there.
Another lost talent. He was so great.
Yeah, well, it was hard in those days to be an actor and black. Sidney Poitier fixed it. Mm-hmm. He slew the dragon that said that if you were black, there wasn't an audience.
And you wound up in a film with him, for Love of Ivy.
Yes, when he was at the peak of his career.
1968. But that's it. Those are the three films you were in. Two of them real successes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe all three real successes in their own way. And yet you didn't get too many other job offers, or that wasn't where you wanted to go?
I didn't get job offers. But, you know, I remember Dorothy Dandridge. She made the cover of Time magazine. She was beautiful and a great actress. And there wasn't a career for her. And I knew there wouldn't be one for me. I didn't entertain really that fantasy. When I didn't get any follow-up offers, the offers I did get, I didn't want them.
Mm-hmm. In the 70s, early 70s, there were a slew of films directed at African-American audiences.
Blaxploitation films.
But you didn't
there weren't any really... There's nothing that they made in the 70s that I wish that I had been in.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm thankful that I had a chance to do these films.
Two, anybody would be proud to be in. But I think the girl can't help it, is you know, you look at that film again. That is a truly hilarious movie of its time, don't you think? I mean, Frank Tashlin.
Yeah, he was brilliant.
Yeah, he came out of cartoons, and he made movies that were almost like cartoons. And he was a comic genius. So three wonderful films.
He wrote it, directed it, and produced it, and he was making a comment on the times, mm-hmm. right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
but that's something you became interested in yourself. Partly because through your experiences with Max Roach? You met Max Roach around the time...
No, Roach, that was before Roach.
Uh-huh.
When I met Roach...
No, I mean in the 60s around the... didn't you?
I met Roach in 55, 54, when I came back from Honolulu. But from that time until around 57, when we started to see each other again, I had made a career for myself as a glamour queen.
Mm-hmm.
And so Roach, because he had heard me in another setting, took thought of me as a serious singer and encouraged me to throw all of that away. He said to me, Abby, I don't like that dress, mm-hmm. the Marilyn Monroe dress. He was the only one who said that to me. And I stopped wearing it. And he helped me over the years to develop as a serious singer, because he's a great musician, and he was a wonderful teacher to me.
He was also going through a very heavily political period in his life. And
both of us went there.
You both became very political as a result. It works wonderfully in Nothing But a Man, but there's always that problem of making art that's political and that winds up really being art.
Yes, it put a lot of people off, I think, because if you say something that's pertinent, Billie Holiday went through this when she sang Strange Fruit. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to sing songs like that.
And nowadays, Strange Fruit just seems like the most appropriate song for its age.
Yes. Bessie Smith sang Black Mountain Blues. Up on Black Mountain, the child will smack your face. Babies crying for liquor, and all the birds sing bass. So this has been going on a long time. Mm-hmm. But some people see themselves as, in a way, as historians. You can see the world through the music that you leave, something about the way things were.
Some people remember you best as the first woman they ever saw in an afro.
Yes. I think it was special because I was I had an image as a glamorous woman, and when I wore my hair natural, it made an impression on a lot of people. And I remember going to Los Angeles and seeing all these beautiful young women with big afros. Some of them were really like the sun. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we freed ourselves up to wear our hair any way we want to wear it, because it's really a prolific strand, this African strand. It does all kinds of things.
Well, you don't wear it anymore.
I wear it braided.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Let's listen to a little bit more from the album, take a break, and come back and find out what happened. Because suddenly you disappeared, or at least it seemed like you disappeared. I thought you'd gone to Europe or something and established another kind of career. We'll find out what you actually did and how you have come back with such a bang.
Thank you.
Down here below, the winds of change are blowing through the weary night. I pray my soul will find me shining in the morning light.
I can't think of any other singer who sings like Abby Lincoln. Her singing goes right to my heart. I could only think of some of the greats of the past who had that effect on me. But I don't remember you having that effect all along. There's something that has been added since you've come back in the last 10 years.
Well, when I left New York in 1970... And I gave up my marriage and my career. I really didn't know that I was going to be going through what I did.
Now, why did you give it up? It was just because getting too oppressive?
Yeah, it's like throw it away. If things don't please you, if you're not happy, well, I didn't know I was leaving my career. Mm-hmm. But I did when I went to Los Angeles. I made a couple of television shows. And then I started to paint, and I cleansed my spirit of resentment and disappointment and all that. I just worked. I researched the Encyclopedia Britannica's. My landlord gave me some old ones, and I researched other worlds and old worlds.
So you were teaching yourself after all those years of having worked.
Yes. And it was all that I was going through and the sorrow that expanded my instrument. Also, I was studying with this great teacher, David Collier, before I left New York. And my instrument started to get bigger and wider and deeper. And scared me a little bit at first. But I just practiced the arts. This is what I did. And I saved myself from a lot of grief. And I learned to be wiser. And
you were living with your mother for part of this time.
Yes, I went to California to my mother's house because that was home. And it was my solace. It was a sanctuary for me. It was the only place I knew that I could go. It was my mother's house. Mm-hmm. And I was with her for the last 7 years of her life. I lived very modestly.
You were teaching?
for a year I taught at Northridge Theater. I didn't go to university, though, you know. And I thought, I don't have any really business here. I don't know anything about this approach to education. And I didn't like it anyway. But it helped me to live. The universities subsidize the artists here, thank God. And they make it easier for a lot of people who practice the arts. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I gave that up. And I never did stop singing. And I worked with wonderful musicians in Los Angeles.
And when did you start writing? Because in the history of jazz, we have a lot of great singers, but except for a few blues tunes, or Billie Holiday wrote a couple mm-hmm. of songs, Sarah Vaughan, Carmen McRae wrote more than a couple, but none of them ever attempted what you've been doing, which is putting out albums that are largely of your own writings.
Yes.
You put in a couple of standards and everything else is new to us.
Yes.
That almost seems to me to be a legacy of rock and roll, where you get the singer-songwriter.
Or of Thelonious Monk, mm-hmm. who the great ones always wrote songs. And Thelonious, I'd always written lyrics. And I was writing words to everybody's compositions. mm-hmm. I didn't ask them. I just add lyrics. And Thelonious, I wrote a lyric to Blue Monk, and he let me use it. I recorded it, and he added it to the song. But later on, he was quoted as on a liner notes for an album called Straight Ahead. He said, "Abby Lincoln has to make it because she's not only a great singer and a great actress, she's a great composer."
Well, that's very nice.
Yeah, it took me a long time to figure it out, though. But you know what? I believed him. And I started to believe the melodies that I heard. People in Me was the first one. Mm-hmm. It was a real simple child song. And I sang it.
And you get the feeling that all of these songs are autobiographical in a way that
you're right.
That most songs aren't. Mm-hmm. Most songwriters write songs, you know, mm-hmm. and you write in this genre, that genre. These sound like they really come out of
your experiences. Yeah.
Interestingly, even though you didn't go to Europe, like I assumed, it mm-hmm. was a French producer who got you back into the business.
Yes.
Jean-Philippe Allard, who started recording you in 1988.
Yes.
But got you onto Verve Records here, which is...
He represents Verve in Paris. And he called me on the phone one day and asked me what I wanted to do. It's wonderful. It's the first time I've ever been associated with a major label and had a chance to record one album after another. Every year I make an album.
Mm-hmm. And with the musicians that people dream about making albums with. You recorded with Stan Getz before he
yes.
died. And on this latest album, you have some of the best young musicians, Roy Hargrove, Kenny Barron, who may be one of my four or five favorite pianists in the world.
Pat Metheny
on many of the dates. Yeah. Lucky Peterson playing
yeah,
as
Victor
well.
Lewis. Just a wonderful. But
Jean-Philippe
helps me to decide who we're going to. He thinks of people that I don't think. Yes, you know, I'm the conduit, though. I'm the one mm-hmm. who decides what tempo it's going to be and what kind of colors they will have. I do the first chorus, and the musicians, they're wonderful. Because they hear everything, and they bring you things that are beyond, you can't really imagine them. So they're head arrangements for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And at this point, since you're writing most of the songs, I imagine you have more songs than you can handle, or do you want to go back sometime to reinterpreting the
I am
the standards?
Going to do this, I think, for the next album. I'm talking to my producer, and I have some live tapes live, that material I did in 57 and 58.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we should go back to A Turtle's Dream, your latest album on Verve, and listen to one of the only standards on it, a little bit of Nature Boy.
Yes.
I'm sure But I'm sure you could not have sung this song the way you do it now, 15, 20 years ago.
It's maybe 15 years, or even, yeah, 15, not maybe, 15, not, years ago, I could have. 20 years ago. But before 1970, I was still a girl. You know, she was still this girl, and I became more womanly.
Abby Lincoln, the woman, from her album A Turtle's Dream on Verve. Thank you so much for being on New York.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Leonard. Sad of eyes.